Welcome to Where Did the Road Go? Be sure to check us out online at www.wheredidtheroadgo.com. Now enjoy this edition of the Midweek Podcast.
So this is a Where Did the Road Go Midweek Podcast. This week I have Red Pill Junkie and Joshua Cutchin. Michael Hughes was unavailable. He is currently abducted by aliens, or maybe Bigfoot, and deep in the planet Jupiter.
Better than Uranus.
Yes, I was waiting for that. So, one of the things I wanted to get to a few weeks ago that we never got around to talking about, when it comes to whatever you want to call this, Fortiana, the paranormal, unexplained stuff, There's no school you go to. You know, if you want to become an engineer, you go to college, you study to be an engineer, you pass certain courses, you may be a sucky engineer, but you're still an engineer and have a basic, you know, level of expertise. Mm-hmm. But if you're investigating UFOs or hauntings, what makes someone an expert in these fields?
You hear a lot of people say that there are no experts in these fields. And I think I get what they're trying to say because, you know, we know nothing objectively about it. But I think that I also have to disagree with that to a certain point, because if someone is well-versed of what the phenomena tends to do and they're willing to say, oh, you know, this tends to happen, and if they're well-versed on the dates of certain landmark cases and they're, you know, they're very much aware of the people who are in the field and some of the things that have happened, then I think you're completely right to call them an expert of the phenomena or an expert of, you know, the body of cases, if not an expert on the actual thing that they're studying itself.
Red Bill?
That wasn't an answer on how you get to that point, yeah. Though. Sorry.
Yeah, it's such a difficult question to answer, because on the one hand, one of the problems I see today with modern science is over specialization in all the fields.
Yeah,
biology. You don't just study biology. You are supposed to specialize in some very narrow, specific area of biology, like maybe octopi, or you know, or some kind of land mammals, you know, giraffes or whatever. You want to become an expert on giraffes, but inside that field. And I think that in the end, one of the characteristics of people who are interested in this field, they tend to have a very holistic view about just about everything, you know, science, history, religion, whatever. Now, the other thing I was thinking about when you posed the question is how some people tend to look at some personalities' credentials, like, for example, we tend to have a high regard about someone like Neil deGrasse Tyson. You know, he's a very popular, very respected astronomer. He has done a lot of things to follow in the footsteps of Carl Sagan in educating the public about science. You know, he's probably one of the biggest science educators in the world today. And you will say, well, you know, he's certainly an authority on science, but will that make him an authority in something like ufology? I will say no, definitely not. I think that, in fact, when he has spoken about UFOs, he has proven a great deal of ignorance about the subject. You know, the things that he tends to say about how the various stereotypical positions about the kind of people who see UFOs, the conditions in which they see UFOs, the way he speaks about them, you will think that UFOs are only nothing but small lights in the sky, that people don't know what they are, so they started to create this yarn about, well, it's obviously, I don't know what it is, so it's obviously a spacecraft from another planet, you know, and that's and all the things that he has also said about alien abductions and whatever. So it's certainly a problem, you know, that people who should have the capacity to reach a bigger audience are more often than not equipped to talk with given authority about what UFOs really are. And at the same time, people who may have a bigger understanding, maybe they don't have the right quote-unquote credentials. Maybe they don't have a college degree. Our friend Micah Hanks, who I think is one of the most important researchers in the UFO field today, well, he doesn't have a college degree. He's thinking about getting one, but mm-hmm. that might discredit him in the eyes of some people, some especially skeptics. So I don't know. And at the same time, one of the other problems we have, like you said, you know, there are no schools in which you might get a quote unquote degree in ufology. Like Peter Robbins has often said, you know, how do you become a UFO expert? Well, you rub your nose and you click your heels twice and voila, you are a UFO expert. And nobody can contend that. I would never claim myself to be a UFO expert. I will always remain a UFO student, and that's quite okay.
The two things that brings to mind. One, in one of David Hatcher Childress's books, I can't remember where he was. I want to say it was in South America. And he's looking at stuff and saying, you know, this stuff looks exactly like stuff you find in China. And the archaeologist he's talking to is going, no, it doesn't. Mm-hmm. And he's like, it does. It, you know, and he's like trying to make points here. And she's like, well, I don't study that, so it doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there you have that separatist. And he's like, you know, how can these people, you know, be so narrow in their views? You know, you would think that if they realize there's a connection, hey, let's go look at it. Instead, they just shut it off. No, this is what I'm an expert on. I don't care about anything else.
Yeah, this is something that Graham Hancock complains about a lot when it comes to the things that he is involved with. You know, like these clues that he has found hinting at the existence a long time ago of a greatly advanced civilization, and how this civilization might have ended up, you know, its ultimate demise at the hands of some incredible natural catastrophe. And people who have come up with clues about this catastrophe, like people like Robert Schock, who is a very, you know, he has the right credentials in his field of geology, but because he's a geologist, archaeologists don't even care to look at his research, at the things that he has found with regards to the erosion on the Sphinx, which mm-hmm. seems to be caused not by winds and the effect of sand over thousands of years, but it seems to be caused by heavy rains.
Yeah, and that's the other thing. He wasn't the one that essentially discovered that.
Mm-hmm.
The person who rediscovered that was John Anthony West, and no one would listen to him because he didn't have any credentials.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that he was right didn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I feel like in terms of what you need to become an expert, I think you need to be a well-rounded person who is constantly thirsting for knowledge, and that interdisciplinary angle is what I think is the only way that we're going to make any headway in any of these fields. I think we need scientists that think like artists and artists that think like scientists. I think we need people who can use both sides of their brain and to look at all different angles of this and to make connections to things that don't seem like they would be related at all. And to do that, you need people who are well-read, and you need people who are interested in learning new things. And I think tragically people just aren't interested in learning new things. Even academia is not interested in learning new things. People are very keen to get settled in one particular rut.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Too true.
And of course, if you get thrown on TV, then you're definitely an expert.
Oh, man. Don't get me started.
And whereas there are some people, who's the guy that did UFO Chasers? Or was it UFO Chasers?
You know UFO, what I'm talking about? Was it UFO Hunters? Was that
James Fox?
Fox, yes.
James Fox?
Yeah, James Fox came away from that being like, what was that? That was crap. I can't believe they made me do that, you know?
Yeah.
And so he didn't have the big head, but I think when you get to some of these ghost hunting shows and stuff, these guys feel like they are the top of the top. They are the experts because they're on TV and everyone loves them.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you get tied up in your own ego, and it starts. I think you become this ego Ouroboros, you know.
Yeah.
I remember when I was watching Joe Rogan's sci-fi series, Joe Rogan Questions Everything. And, you know, first off, I'm a big fan of Joe Rogan. I think that the things that he's done with his podcast, the Joe Rogan Experience, is nothing short of tremendous.
Absolutely.
It's a great benefit having him exposing a young audience to people like Graham Hancock and Randall Carlson and all those people, you know. But at the same time, I was so disappointed with that particular TV show, especially the episode about UFOs, you know, because first off, I think that the things he tried to cover, like Skinwalker Ranch and something, it's not the kind of thing that you should try to tackle on your first go at the UFOs. It's like, you know, trying in your first day of trying to learn piano, and then you want to try to play, you know, Chopin's, I don't know, number 5 concerto or whatever.
Right.
You know, it's like, wow, small step, dude. And then the second is like the people he interviewed or went to during that show is not the people that I would think are better equipped to have a reasoned and an authoritative take on the phenomenon. And it's not that I'm, very critical of those people. One of those was Jason McClelland, who I knew on the first Paradigm Symposium, and I like him. But other people like Bill Burns, well, you know, the former editor of the UFO magazine, I know that there are people who have a lot of exposure because of the UFO Hunters TV show and mm-hmm. whatever, so they cannot become the go-to people in this field. But what about, and I was thinking that what if Joe Watt had tried to have someone like, I don't know, Leslie Keen, Jacques Vallée, all those people who don't have that level of exposure, but I think that they have a more authoritative position on something that would be of more value if they had their 5 minutes in front of the camera.
See, now, Jacques Vallée is someone I would consider to be a UFO expert.
Definitely. Yes. No argument there.
And there's not a lot of people that fit that criteria, but he's one of them.
Mm-hmm.
You could say Whitley Strieber's an expert on the abduction side of it.
Hmm.
Partially because of his own experiences and as many interactions as he's had with other people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the thing. There's also this feeling that if you're investigating this stuff and you've never had an experience, it separates you from it. Like you can't fully understand it without ever having had the experience.
Mm-hmm. Although Jacques had a sighting of his own when he was young.
Yeah, yeah. And by the way, that's what got him into it.
Yeah. By the way, guys, did you read that Reddit Ask Me Anything with him?
No.
No, I hadn't gotten around to
it out. No, there's a few interesting answers that he gave to some very interesting questions. You know, most of them weren't kind of crap, but you know, there were a few of them that were very intelligent, and you know, he gave a very intelligent answer.
He seems to be becoming more involved than he has been in recent years. Is that the perception that I'm getting? I mean, he's going to be at the UFO Congress next year, I believe, right?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh. I'm thinking about going.
And he's been on Coast to Coast a couple of times.
Mm-hmm. And he had this Kickstarter campaign to try to fund this deluxe edition of Wonders in the Sky.
Hmm.
Yeah, and you know what's interesting about him is that you look at him, and that's sort of exactly what I'm talking about. Somebody who is interested in learning different things and interested in applying. You know, I would have never thought to apply certain, information systems ideas to the UFO phenomena, but right. I mm-hmm. think that his control system idea still has a lot of legs to it, and I think that's the sort of people that we need to be encouraging to get involved. Are people who, are really good. But you know what? Let's even go stranger. Like let's encourage people who have PhDs in concrete construction to get involved, because you never know where that extra one connection could be. Yeah.
We should definitely encourage a multidisciplinary atmosphere
yes.
in this field. People with PhDs are more than welcome to try to come and give their opinion and, help us try to understand the phenomenon. But I also think, that our friend Mike Clellan is quite right. Artists are as much equipped or maybe even better equipped to try to understand this phenomenon as someone who is too left brain dominated. In their approach, in their reasoning.
The other thing with people once they get a PhD is they have that PhD and it's a very dogmatic viewpoint at that point.
Mm-hmm.
They've been taught this is how the world is.
Mm-hmm.
You've fed it back to us. Here's your PhD, and then they become very very unwilling to look openly at this stuff. And sometimes it's fear of ridicule. And other times it may just be that they feel they already know the answers. What's the answer to psychic abilities? Well, there aren't any,
Yeah, because they are accustomed to think that if it's not covered in a peer-reviewed journal, it's not bother looking at.
Right, right.
Well, I totally know how it is to pull your punches for the way that you really feel. Because, at the end of the day, these people want to keep their jobs, Exactly. So if someone's involved in academia and has a PhD, on the one hand, they should be interested. But on the other hand, I totally get it. I don't think it's good that the culture of academia is so dismissive of these subjects. But at the same time, if you're in that culture and that culture is what puts food on your table, then... Yeah, I get it.
You got to change the culture more than anything else.
Right, right.
Yeah, and how does it speak about the atmosphere of academia that someone like Carl Sagan, who seems to have been a very active consumer of cannabis, never spoke openly about, the benefits of cannabis consumption. I think that he wrote a few things supporting the use of cannabis, but using a pseudonym.
And to look at this from another angle too, I think the level of focus that you need to get a PhD automatically starts to narrow your interests and starts to narrow the things that you can allow yourself to be interested in. We only have so many hours in the day, and you sort of end up. That's going to sound so bad. The PhD process sort of ends up nurturing the narrowing of perspective, I think.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. You do have a few PhDs that have done stuff in alternative fields. John Mack, obviously, being one. Kenneth Ring. And yes. Mack, they tried to get rid of him. They tried to fire him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's... I as we've seen recently with free speech issues on college campuses, academia is not the bastion of thought that a lot of people want to make it out to be.
Yeah, but these recent, the recent stuff is very recent, I think.
Yes. No, I mean, to that degree, yes. But I think that it's the difference between something being overt and something having existed for a long time, sort of in a de facto manner. But among, you know, it's that to have this sort of chilling effect amongst the sort of things that people can look into, I think has existed for a while.
I mean, am I wrong in assuming that universities stopped being the cutting edge centers of research and scientific advance, you know, since several decades ago? You know, that nowadays it's on the private industry when they make those great advances and those great discoveries, but not on academic circles anymore.
I think that industry has everything to gain from innovation that, in some sense, traditional academia has to lose. You know, you think about academia has to tell you that this is the way that the world works, this is the way that things are. You know, here's your printed textbook. And on the other hand, private industry, you know, if something is completely different, then that's great. That means that we can, you know, the bottom line's going to be better and we can, you know, can approach this and tackle this problem in a different way. So I think that's really where that comes from. I still think that there are some very good universities out there that are doing, you know, a yeoman's work and really trying to make sure that there's a good body of new research coming out. But I feel like the academic, I feel like the advancements in thought made in academia tend to be on a much smaller scale than the advancements made in the private sector in terms of developments.
Yeah. I think part of the problem is that how they, let me just finish this one thing. See, that the one part of the problem is that how they share information. You know, if you want to read a scientific paper released by a university, you have to pay for it, and you have to sometimes pay an exorbitant amount.
Yeah,
I think that this guy, Aaron Schwartz, you know, the guy who killed himself trying to fight that very antiquated system, is highlights one of the problems on how these guys, I mean, these guys write papers that are only read by a handful of their colleagues, and they then complain of how the public is so misinformed about the what they're doing.
Yeah, I was looking into an academic article for the other day for my current project, and it was going to be $35 for me to download this academic article, and I'm like, you know what, I can just try to find some similar information somewhere else.
Right. Yeah.
So let's play a thought experiment here. What if the academic system is the way it is because there is somewhere a breakaway civilization that doesn't want quick advancement on our end?
Well, I think that the break... I personally think that the breakaway civilization has a lot of merit to it, that particular idea. At the same time, I have difficulty conceiving, and this probably says more about me than it does about the theory, exactly how said breakaway civilization would implement and interface with society while still remaining, you know, breakaway and secret. I just have trouble wrapping my head around it. Doesn't mean it's not a possibility. It's just I have trouble with that theory from that standpoint.
Okay,
I'm not sure. I mean, to me, I've always thought that this is a very unconscious and almost automatic process of perpetuating a certain viewpoint, like a machinery that drives itself. And some people learn very rapidly how you can either work with the system or against the system, and people who work with the system or are the ones who reap the benefits of it, and they know then how the game is played, and nobody has to, you know, be next to them and trying to feed them the things that the breakaway civilization wants them to do. Like, for example, you know, I don't think that there is some insider from the big breakaway civilization work.
Hello?
Yeah.
Okay. I want to make sure it wasn't just me. We lost you there for about 7 seconds. Oh.
Is he still gone?
I'm here.
There you are. Okay. Yeah, we lost the end of what you were saying.
Oh, So I'm very skeptical of the idea that there's an insider of the breakaway civilization or the secret cabal, the New World Order, working in every single academic center or in every single newspaper or TV station, trying to silence all those who wants to, you know, study UFOs or want to keep a very credit to a UFO story. You know, I don't think that's the way it is. I think that's a very unconscious process in which, you know, the system tends to move in a certain direction and is very reactive to people who try to turn the wheel to the other direction.
And I don't disagree with that. I mean, I'm not really sure how I feel about the breakaway civilization idea. I definitely think it's a possibility.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think it would actually take that much. I mean, when you consider that the media is only owned by like six people, and if you put that culture, if you encourage that culture academically, you don't have to do it on every college campus. If you just get it so people are afraid to speak out. You know, if you use that ridicule factor whenever they talk about something that you don't want them talking about.
Yeah, and, you know, a thought just occurred to me, too. What if this whole idea of the breakaway civilization is right in front of us and is just private industry? Like, the larger corporations are, you know, you hear people talk about company culture and about things like that. What if some of the larger companies that control a lot of our food and control a lot of our media, what if they're kind of the breakaway civilization that we're looking for?
It's certainly a possibility. There could be a whole other side to them we never see.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that some people have speculated that it was during the Nixon administration that the quote-unquote UFO secret that was in possession of the government was transferred to the private industry.
Yep, I've heard that too.
And I don't know. I mean, I can say, how can anyone prove that? You know, it's like I said, it's an interesting possibility, it's an interesting thought experiment, and I think that, yeah, it's a good argument that keeping a secret inside the private companies who don't have to respond to the queries of the public is a much efficient way of keeping those kind of confidential information.
Well, that's also the argument of why NASA started outsourcing to some of these companies. I mean, NASA is supposed to be run by civilians.
Mm-hmm.
And now so much of their stuff is run through private companies who get first shot at all the data.
Mm-hmm.
And don't have to release it if they don't want to.
Well, you know, this entire idea is a nice way to sidestep around people who say the government can't keep a secret, blah blah blah. You know, people keep in the private sector, people honor non-disclosure agreements all the time for long amounts of time. You know, you have somebody patent something and you buy it from them and say you can't ever reveal this to anyone ever again. Nobody ever hears, you know, nobody ever hears the formula or whatever the person invented ever again. It just stays with the company. So, I think that secrets are guarded in the private industry much better than they are in the public sector.
I mean, because you have you had a point where NASA was, you know, showing you pictures as these probes were taking them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you saw the first, you could sit there and watch on television as the first images of Jupiter came in and Saturn and Uranus and Neptune. And, it was all direct to you. The raw images were right there. And then every once in a while they caught anomalous things, and who knows what they actually were, but suddenly everything is privately owned, and we'll show it to you when we want to, and we're probably not going to show it all to you.
Did you guys watch that commercial made by Pepsi about the Black Knight?
No. I saw something about it, and I didn't get around to seeing it, no. But yeah, yeah, well, I saw something about it.
It was so freakish, you know, this... The Pepsi using that internet myth about the Black Knight being this 15,000-year-old alien satellite. But the thing that's interesting is that what they used to make that commercial was footage that was taken from this camera that is owned by a Canadian company. I think the name of the company is Urtecast. But that camera is on board the International Space Station. So that's like kind of weird. So the International Space Station has a camera that is owned by a private company.
That is wild.
But not shocking.
No, no, not at all.
Well, I mean, you're right, Sarai. I mean, I saw that there was a meme going around Facebook that was suggesting that politicians should wear jumpsuits similar to race car drivers, so you know who's sponsoring them.
That would be so great.
So here's the thing with the Black Knight.
Mm-hmm.
The first I ever heard of the Black Knight was John Keel.
Really?
And John Keel's recollection of the Black Knight was that it was a satellite that shadowed Sputnik when it was first sent up.
Mm.
Beyond that, there didn't seem to be anything else. And then suddenly all I'm hearing is, oh, the Black Knight is a 15,000-year-old satellite. And I'm like, where is all this coming from? Where is this evidence coming from?
Yeah, I mean, have they carbon dated the Black Knight satellite? I don't think so.
I think it will be fairly easy to try to do a Google search in how the search for the term Black Knight, how far does it go? You know, it started in the 1990s. Started in the mid 2000s when that myth really took off. You know, the idea that Nikola Tesla and Marconi, you know, got those signals coming from the Black Knight, and then Philip K. Dick also, when he was, you know, in contact with Ballis and also that. And I think that is something that's like a snowball. It has been growing out of all these disparate things that some people have tried to connect into a single mythology. And now this mythology is brought to you by Pepsi.
Because I know when Keel talked about it, you know, he said it was on a polar orbit. They didn't know what it was, but it seemed to be, as I said, shadowing Sputnik. It would come around and kind of like was examining it. But that was it.
Mm.
There was nothing else after that. And now suddenly it has this whole history and timeline. And like you said, it's like little pieces being put together and added into it.
And what of his Keel's books is where he mentions this?
Yeah, I don't remember which one though.
I don't know off the top of my head either.
I've read them all.
Yeah, and I read an article not that long ago, in which a guy, you know, I think very convincingly debunked the alleged photos of the Black Knight. You know, I think he was very convincing in showing that it was just like debris from some old space program.
Yeah, I remember that.
Well, I mean, there's so much stuff up there. I'm sure that there's a lot of misidentification too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there'd have to be. I mean, we don't even know all the junk that's up there at this point.
You know, something occurred to me. I mean, with all this sudden assignment of lore to the Black Knight satellite, that sort of sounds a little bit like maybe a deliberately constructed red herring. Like, I'm not usually the biggest fan of ideas of disinformation and stuff like that. I mean, we know it happens. But it's almost like let's give the UFO community something really tantalizing, and maybe if we can, you know, knock, you know, a couple hundred people off of the scent of something a lot more important, we can do it with this fanciful, you know, mysterious satellite and all its lore. I mean, like, not to say that it maybe is something truly anomalous, but I'm talking about the more in depth stories that you were mentioning about Marconi and Tesla and Dick.
Yeah, and we do know that, you know, the intelligence agencies in the United States do have spy satellites with very unknown capabilities. I think they have the capability to change orbits and to, you know, be easily, not as easily tracked by amateur astronomers as a regular satellite is.
Well, you know, I mean, I'm constantly reminded of the technology that I feel like every 2 years or so we get some sort of new invisibility cloaking technology news. You know, they've been able to now, you know, they can have cameras on both sides of this blanket and they can, looks like you're looking straight through it. I don't feel like it ever really goes anywhere, but if the rule of thumb that you always hear about the black world versus the white world is true, then man, it's got to be incredibly well implemented and incredibly well developed by this point. That technology,
yeah.
But the and that's the problem nowadays. We don't know what else is out there. I mean, breakaway civilization or not, we do have secret black projects that are going to be decades ahead of what they're revealing to us now. And maybe more than decades at this point, because look how fast our technology advances.
Well, right, and our technology has become indistinguishable from a lot of the things that we in years past would have thought were truly anomalous. Now, everybody points to drones. I actually saw my first drone earlier this year for the first time, because I hadn't, for whatever reason, I hadn't really ever seen one where I hadn't been looking up when one was above me. And it's a very unsettling experience the first time you see one, because it's moving strange and it doesn't have the lights that you're used to. And I was actually in the middle of a parade at the time. And I was like, playing and watching this drone. And I'm like, I don't want to miss my first UFO because I'm playing the dang sousaphone. Yeah.
We were driving back from Rochester this week, I don't know, time's kind of wishy-washy. Must have been this week, I guess. And as I'm coming into the city of Geneva, it overviews Seneca Lake. And I see this light come down, and it moves, and then it kind of shifts direction and moves back, and then it shifts again, and then it kind of drops down, and I'm going, all right, that's not a plane. There's no airports around here. What the hell am I looking at? I'm like, I bet it's a drone. And then as we got closer down the side of the lake, there were probably a million cop lights and ambulances and stuff. And I'm like, even more likely it was a drone now, because someone was either checking out what was going on over there or it was actually police run in some way.
You know, Soraya, this brings up an interesting question that just came to mind. As someone who has seen... You believe that you have seen things that are anomalous lights in the sky that are not, that do not jump out as drones, right?
Right.
So as someone who has seen both that and has seen drones, is there anything that feels different about the two sightings? Like, you know, like we always hear about, you know, the sort of intuitive angle that you get from seeing these strange things, and I'm just wondering if there's, you know, I mean, people who feel anxious at seeing Sasquatch don't feel that way when they see a black bear. You know, there's something intuitive that tells them that it's different. Do you ever notice any difference?
No, I really don't. I've never had the Oz factor during a UFO sighting. The one that really was a novelist, the giant thing over the lake. That's what I was actually paying attention to. I'm like, I don't feel weird. I don't feel like, you know, anything's different. I feel like I'm just driving the car, you know, pulled over, listened, didn't hear a sound, but nothing felt out of place.
Interesting.
And I, you know, and even with a drone, there's nothing to explain the size of the thing I saw, because, I mean, drones are, it's, you know, what I saw coming into Geneva was a small light moving in a weird way. You know, this thing was probably, you know, 5 to 10 football fields wide.
Okay.
Jeez Louise.
And the only way I could tell that is because it started dropping down into the lake and it moved in front of the trees. And these giant trees looked tiny in front of it.
Man.
So I'm pretty sure it wasn't a drone. This was also like 2000, so drones weren't super common at the time.
Well, and the point of drones is to get smaller and smaller, I would think. You know, yeah. that's part of the benefit of it.
Yeah, they keep showing us images of mosquito-like, tiny drones. You know, kind of like thinking, oh well, next time I'm going to swat this fly that's bothering me. Hopefully it doesn't explode.
And if it does, why was it on you?
Exactly.
Who was it and what do they want?
Yeah.
Red Pill Junkie goes underground.
Oh, already. Already ahead of you.
Let's turn this slightly into the idea of labels. And the way we label things, I think, partly creates these separations and these way of dealing with anomalous phenomena that maybe wouldn't be there if we didn't jump to stick a label on.
Have you ever, I did a thought experiment the other day, and I looked at my bed and I said, thought to myself, bed, pillows, sheets, blanket. But all of those words are just complete constructions, you know. There's some sort of thing here that's soft, and the society has said that it's used for, well, among other things, sleep. It's wild to me that, you know, a rose by any other name would smell just as sweet. But once you start thinking about that, and you apply that same sort of logic to more abstract thoughts, you realize that I think without language we'd go insane.
Well, quite possibly. It'd be very hard to communicate.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
but look, if we look at it this way, you know, so someone has a negative encounter, you know, maybe it's in a house, you know, and something that feels oppressive comes up to them. Maybe they see a shadow or whatever. And then a researcher comes in and says, well, it's demonic. Well, now you've created a whole system of connections with that word, that label, that may have nothing to do with the actual encounter.
Well, yeah, and how much of expectation from that point forward plays into it? I mean, you know, with my new project, I was doing some research on the role that language plays in smell, and they proposed an experiment to do with your friends. Put some Parmesan cheese in a cup, tell them to close their eyes and put it under their nose and tell them that it's Parmesan cheese. And they'll be like, oh, that's great. It smells wonderful. Put it under their nose and tell them that someone puked in the cup and they'll have a much different reaction. You know, so, I mean, there have been examples of studies where an orange smelling liquid has been dyed red. And people will actually call the smell cherry.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, our senses are so in flux at all times from so many different things.
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing. You can't fully trust your senses. You know, they give us a good, you know, guiding through this material reality, but they're just interpretations and partially expectations.
It's sensory information that at the end of the day has to be interpreted by our, you know, central nervous system.
Right.
And sometimes the central nervous system has a really hard time making sense of what the senses are, the sensory input it's receiving. And that's something that I've been thinking about for a long time, but more recently this year, because of all these things, you know, this craziness regarding Google's Deep Dream. You remember all those crazy-ass images
that
is fed back to the Deep Dream algorithm. And now, you know, for example, Alan Moore's photograph, you know, and it looks like a crazy hound from hell, you know. It's an image that is something like created by this guy. What was the name of this medieval artist who created images of people using vegetables, you know, and he put, you know, the noses, like it was like a cabbage, and the ear is like a flower, something like that. I think that kind of program, it will be tremendously helpful in trying to understand how perception and interpretation shapes our reality.
Yeah.
Archimboldo is the name of the guy, that artist.
Here's the other thing I wonder is, let me think if I can get his name here. Gerhard on, talking about really like winged humanoids. And some of the stories are beyond bizarre, that these people, you know, witnessed these creatures that just make no logical sense whatsoever and have never been seen again by anybody else.
Yeah.
So if we assume that they're reporting honestly what they think they saw, the question is, what was really there, and what did their brain do with it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, did they see a strange type of energy and their brain just grasped through to go, how do I define this? How do I show this to you? And then just picked a crazy monster and went, this is what you're seeing. And your brain goes, oh, my God.
Mm-hmm.
And so then you honestly report it. But what was actually there was not this crazy monster, but something your brain simply didn't have any kind of relevance to. It didn't have anything to compare it to show you what it was witnessing, what vibrations were coming through to it.
Yeah.
Co-creation. And speaking of Greg and Radio Mysterioso, Greg Bishop, there was an article, I don't know if you saw this, RPJ, that was posted to that group. I forgot who posted it, but it was talking about how perhaps up to 90% of your perception is made up by your brain.
Didn't read it, but I totally agree.
Yeah, it's interesting. It really is, because I feel like, you know, I feel like there has to be some sort of aspect that we're putting into these experiences. It's just too weird and too personal to be anything otherwise, you know. Although I will say that I don't, here's on the flip side, I think that there is something objective to the experience, because if it was all user generated, like a tulpa or something, I feel like we would see many more pop culture, pop culture entities. Like we would see Luke Skywalker running around, and we would see H.R. Giger's alien running around, you know. I feel like if it was completely user generated, it would be, so we would see a lot more of that.
Well, I think that what was the name of this guy who was on the Paradigm Symposium, the guy who wrote the book about the black-eyed kids?
Oh, Weatherly.
Yeah, David Weatherly. In his last appearance in the Paradigm Symposium in 2013, he talked about this apparition, I think it happened in Poland, of a flying man on a blue suit and a red cape. You know, people saw freaking Superman. So it does happen.
And then there are some odd flying humanoid stories out there too.
Yeah.
Especially when you go back in time, where we didn't have technologies and stuff, and in some cases we couldn't even fly airplanes, and you have what look like humanoid figures flying up in the sky. Now there's 100 different things they could be.
Yeah, I saw someone attach a an Iron Man balloon to a drone. There's a video of that on the internet, and they take it up in the sky, and it looks like a person flying around through the sky.
There's all sorts of drones that look like superheroes flying. But I remember that video that was, I think, was recorded in the 90s here in Mexico. I think it was in the northern state of Nuevo León. And what looks like, for all the world, to be like a witch flying on a broom. And the people are saying, oh, looks, es una bruja, looks like a witch. And you will say, well, maybe it wasn't one of these drones, but those drones, those commercial drones, didn't exist back then.
Yeah, I remember that video.
And you know, something that really struck me, and I'm going to bring it up again, Patrick Harper's Demonic Reality. He's talking about how cultures around the globe that have seen lights in the sky have very, like, you know, a lot of them say witches, you know, there's witch lights. So, you know, when you're not seeing structured craft, I mean, who knows, maybe the only things that look like structured craft are the close-up sightings, and everything that's a light is actually a flying humanoid at night. You know, we have no way of knowing.
Yeah. But maybe the structured craft also comes about because we label it as such.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, I mean, it's kind of funny. When I was fighting my interest in alien abduction, because we've talked in length about the role of close encounters of the fourth, third kind rather. I was one of the things that I personally used to use to discredit the UFO phenomena was, well, look. Certain geographical areas report certain things. Latin America is famous for having, you know, short hairy dwarves. The actual appearance of these entities has changed over time. I refuse to believe that there are, you know, eight different races visiting Earth. That's goofy. But it's interesting now that I'm away from that. That is one of the aspects that I find most interesting. The phenomena is somehow tied to cultures. It's somehow tied. The representation of it is tied to cultures and tied to local thought and belief. And to me, that does suggest that there is something a little bit hinkier going on than you know, eight different races coming and visiting people.
Okay, but you know, I remember this case I read in a book by Juan José Benítez of an indigenous woman living in Peru, you know, so, you know, of Inca descent or one of those ethnic groups. I think the woman had a herd of sheep, and when one day she found that there was this something like an Irish leprechaun that was killing her sheep. You know, this was a small individual with a pale skin, a red nose, and reddish hair, you know, using some kind of a weird jetpack, you know, didn't have like some kind of helix or something. And the woman fought this gnomish individual, you know, and managed to kick him out, or kick off his property, and the guy and this entity, you know, managed to escape, floating away. So when you read something like that, you say, well, why is it that a woman from Native American ethnic background sees something that would have been better suited to someone of a Celtic background, someone who will, if they say, oh, I saw a leprechaun or I saw a fairy, you will say, well, of course, because you know, you come from this culture when they are accustomed to interpret paranormal phenomena in those terms. But why is it that a woman who doesn't share that cultural baggage sees something that is something almost comes out of an Irish folk tale?
That's a great question, and to me that really does suggest, you know, the objectivity, the actual, you know, the objectivity of the phenomena, that there is something going on that is external from us. Just, I mean, it's similar to me of people who report some of the more, or rather some of the less popular hallmarks of the abduction phenomena, you know. You know, I think that there are some people who describe certain things that are only really known to people who are interested in these subjects. People who have had no interest at all are like, yeah, the room, there wasn't a single sound around me, and, you know, the entity got up in my face and I started feeling love. It's like, you know, most that you don't see that in popular culture ever. But people who have no interest in this subject will report that. So, yeah, I mean, it's. That's a great point, RPJ.
Yeah, well, I mean, you got the gray alien phenomena as well. I mean, even though it's more of a Western thing, people in primitive cultures even will occasionally see the gray aliens among other types of forms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, I wonder if you look at the I've wondered a long time if you look at the attributes that have seemed to remain consistent for the most part, short stature, large eyes. I wonder if there might not be some sort of clue in there that we're not getting. I don't know really what that is, but I've sometimes wondered, okay, well, everything else seems so varied. What about the things that remain the same? Is there something in there that we can actually learn from?
You do get the occasional giants, though.
You do.
It's so out there, but the eyes, I think, are one of the more important things, because you see it in a lot of, like, cryptozoology cases as well. You know, glowing red eyes, or what Keel called the red-eyed monster.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
I wanted to read this real quick. Jane Roberts channeled entity Seth, which is the only one I can give any credence to whatsoever, because, well, he seems to have been accurate on so many things. As far as UFOs go, he didn't say a whole lot, but he said, you cannot understand perceived events unless you understand who perceives them. You must learn more about the slant of your own consciousness before you're in a position to ask truly pertinent questions about the reality you perceive. Until you ask deeper questions about yourselves, these other experiences, such as UFO sightings, will remain mysterious.
Well, then we're truly hopeless as a society.
But I also remember, I can't find the quote, him saying something like about them being from another reality, and that they're formed of consciousness. And that hit a point with me, because I realized so many times experiencers say, you know, they see a light in the sky, but it seems to be almost like it's conscious or alive.
Yeah.
Or even sometimes the craft seems to be alive, even though it looks like a metallic craft. And you think, if this is a projection of consciousness from somewhere else, it could be completely morphic.
It reminds me of, is it Robert Houllet? Is that his name? RPJ, do you know what I'm talking about?
The guy who was interviewed by Tim Binal?
Yeah. This sort of idea of a cultural poltergeist, an airborne cultural poltergeist almost.
Yeah.
You know, the idea that it's somehow this manifestation, it sounds like it straddles somewhere between collective unconscious and poltergeist phenomena manifesting in the sky.
Yeah, and he mentioned in that interview the famous Philip experiment, you know, which I think is something that maybe not a lot of ufologists are aware of, much to the detriment of the field. How these guys, these Australian parapsychologists, managed to create this narrative about this completely fictional entity, but then the fictional entity started to answer their questions, started to levitate the chairs and the tables, started to gain power, started to gain some type of physical manifestation, and if that was accomplished by only a small group of people, then who knows what could be accomplished by a large group, a mass of individuals unconsciously.
Yeah, absolutely. And by the way, it was Eric Ouellet. Robert Ouellet was a hockey player, apparently.
Yeah.
So. Yeah.
but yeah, you're right. I mean, it stands to reason that, I mean, you hear about things about, you know, the random number generator experiment that noticed a spike in a synchronicitous spike just prior to 9/11. I think there is something to this idea that the zeitgeist of humanity, as it were, the combined consciousness output can have some sort of effect on reality. And, you know, it's a small jump, really, I think, from a lot of the things that you've been hearing in quantum physics with the observer effect. I think it's a very small jump in logic.
Yeah.
I do have another quote here that's pretty perfect to what we're talking about, again, from Seth. According to the January 12, 1971 material, the means by which interdimensional travel takes place is that the pulsating nature of atoms from the alien plane or reality is changed or distorted enough for them to appear in our reality. What we see, however, a craft, for example, is not necessarily what is actually there, but is partly our interpretation of the event that is actually occurring. Hold in mind that the saucer or cigar shape often seen on your planet is a bastard form having little relation to the structure as it is at home base. The earthly viewer attempts to correlate what he sees with what he supposedly knows or imagines possible in the universe. Mm-hmm. What he sees is something between a horse and a dog that resembles neither. The flying saucer retains that which it can of its original structure and changes what it must.
Yeah,
it's a lot to digest.
It reminds me of Ray Bradbury's wonderful book, The Martian Chronicles. That's one of the short stories in which this elderly couple, they find a Martian that takes the form of their lost son.
Yes.
And then when they go to town, then the Martian transforms into the dead wife of one man and the dead daughter of another. And, you know, it's like this entity was compelled to take the form of the expectations of all those individuals. You know, and I think that's something that maybe is what's happening with this phenomenon as well.
It's so hard, and if that's the case, it's so near impossible to see exactly what it is because we may not be able to conceive of it.
Mm-hmm.
So then, what do we do?
I don't know. It's like in those Harry Potter's movie when what was the Bogart?
Yeah,
the Bogart has one of these entities that took the form of that which you were scared the most of.
What movie was this?
Eh?
What movie was this?
I think it was The Prisoner of Azkaban.
Ah.
And so the only thing that you could do is to use the ridiculous spell and to transform it is something that you will find amusing in order to devoid it of power over you.
Interesting idea.
So maybe that's what we have to do with the phenomenon, you know?
Well, and yeah, I mean, what just popped into my head is this idea of, so if you assume that, for example, with the Bogart, what was consistent between people? Obviously, they didn't see the same thing, but the thing that was consistent was the emotion that it manifested. So, you know, you hear the if there are similarities of emotion, all fear, as it were, curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe these things are pure awe, pure fear, pure curiosity, some sort of outward manifestation of a collective emotional state.
Mm-hmm.
Or not.
Yeah, it reminds me of something that Greg discussed about with the late Bruce Duensing, who unfortunately passed away this year. You know how fear as a carrier wave, it was the concept mm-hmm. that they were discussing in that interview that is on the Radio Misterioso archive, and I encourage everyone to go and download it. So the idea that maybe this phenomenon uses our emotions in order to try to communicate. And, you know, obviously, what is the most powerful emotion you can experience? Well, one of it is fear, something probably one of the first thing that you experience as a conscious being. You know, the other one...
It's not only powerful, but it's easy to get to.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So basically, you know,
and were you going to say love is the other side of it?
Yeah, I guess, you know, love is the other one. You know, the feeling of attraction or feeling of connectedness. You know,
but that's not as easy to stir in somebody as
definitely,
fear is.
Definitely, fear is far easier.
Well, and what do we find more of in accounts? You know. To that point, Sarai, you know, we probably find more fear because it's easier to elicit fear.
Mm-hmm. You also find that sometimes paranormal events react to heightened emotions. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, so maybe mm-hmm. these things are trying to get us more on their level, even if it means provoking fear. They're trying to open us up to something, making mm-hmm. us more sensitive to something that we can't yet see.
Yeah. Yeah, or maybe the phenomenon is in a way. We're talking about altered states of perception here, right? The same mm-hmm. thing happened with psychedelic experience. What are psychedelic substances? Psychedelic substances are catalysts. There are things, are chemicals that boost what's already there in the human psyche, you know? If someone has a lot of, you know, negative thoughts, they take a psychedelic compound and they will have a very negative experience. So it's like a mirror, you know. It's something that reflects what you. It's already inside of you, and maybe that's the same thing with this phenomenon.
And if you look at David Weatherly's Black Eyed Children work, he talks, you know. It talks about how there's very little connection in the experiencers. Like they cover all different varieties of people and everything, but they're often people who are not religious, is one of the only things he found to be in common. Mm. And afterwards, they tend to lean toward a more spiritual path, not necessarily one in particular, but that fear, that horrible traumatic experience opened them up somehow.
Well, you know, human beings are very curious and sometimes stupid creatures. You know, sometimes you really need something to shake you up in order to
shake up your reality.
Yeah, in order to drive some sense into you. You know, sometimes you really need to go have your ass kicked by the universe in order to finally get it.
Well, that's the way. That's the only way that we learn things is to have our asses kicked.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. A bad lesson reinforces things 1,000 times more than a good lesson does.
Absolutely.
That's for sure.
It's the it's the light out of darkness type of thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
When you look back, you find all the bad experiences with the transformative ones.
Yeah.
Not that means I want more of them, necessarily, but if you really need an awakening, it's the sudden bad experiences that shift your view, push your reality in such a way, whereas the good experiences sometimes make you more complacent.
Well, and again, this ties into something that I feel like I say on this podcast every other time I'm on, but, you know, the inherent value in suffering, you know, the inherent yes. value in negative experiences.
Yeah, there's definitely something to be said about trying to put yourself into a situation that you know that is going to make you uncomfortable. Like, first time I went to the Paradigm Symposium, that was like the first time that I traveled abroad all on my own, you know, and it was really a very stressful situation for me. But at the same time, you know, it was one of the best things that I ever have ever done in my life. You know, going and meeting Micah and Nick Redfern and all those people. You know, I grew up so much out of this experience, and that's why it was so rewarding. So it's something about trying to push your limits. You know, sometimes mm-hmm. either little by little, or sometimes, you know, you really have to jump, you know, into the deep end of the pool. And I think that the UFO phenomenon sometimes does that into you. You know, it shakes us. It's meant to shake us out of our complacency and maybe out of our cultural stagnation.
So, correct me if I'm wrong on this, Red Pill.
Mm.
Carlos Castaneda, one of his things was about breaking small habits in order to be more aware of your surroundings.
Yeah, I think that was one of the tenets of Don Juan's philosophy.
Yeah, and that works really, really well.
Yeah, for sure.
It's because it's something I'll do on a fairly regular basis, where you get that robot you takes over on certain things, and mm-hmm. you try to just break it down. And it's a way of seeing more without having to have that traumatic reality shift.
Yeah, it's all
you're encouraging it.
Mm-hmm. It's all about trying to retain fluidity. You know, I think even someone, forget about Carlos Castaneda, Bruce Lee, you know, told you, be as fluid as the water. You know, the water seems so, you know, soft and so, you know, weak. But it, you know, with enough persistence, it can go through the hardest of rocks.
Mm-hmm. That is very true. There was a connection here, though. You find a lot of paranormal stuff happening when, like, for instance, somebody redoes an old house.
Mm.
Change.
And then, you know, suddenly, yeah, the change causes, you know, suddenly hauntings to occur. Or, you know, just the liminal state itself, not one thing or another, that sort of in-between state is where a lot of this stuff happens. And it, you know, I don't know, maybe it has some weird connection to consciousness.
Yeah. This is definitely a phenomenon of twilight.
All right. Well, I think we covered a decent amount tonight.
Yeah, and okay, so now on to the top 10 of the year in review, right?
Oh, well, that's something for the next show.
Or the one after, well, depending on when we do it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And hopefully next time we will have Mike back with us.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And we're going to have some other special guests here and there going into the new year. And there was something else I was going to say, but I'm so tired, I think I forgot what it was.
The Patreon?
Ah, the Patreon, yes. I'm going to be creating a member section for the Patreon. I'm trying every week to get guests to give me a little bit extra, and putting it up right now just as links, but hopefully there'll be a member section very, very soon for that. So if you have a spare few dollars and you want some extra content and eventually some merchandise, go to wheredidtheroadgo.com and become a patron of the show. And there'll be more stuff as well. I just haven't figured it all out yet. But it's very, very cheap, and it's also going to help me create more shows.
We're gonna offer a discounted price on the Soraya, Red Pill, Junkie, Joshua Cutchin, all three in a car cartoon mug.
That's what, oh, yeah. Definitely a collective item.
Yeah.
All right. Awesome. Well, thank you, guys.
You're very welcome. It's a pleasure as always, Soraya.
Yeah. As always, it's really fun to hang out with you guys.